I hate fucking microphones. And you'll know why shortly.
Preset?
Where's the thing? Is it? Oh, there it is. Very good.
It became part of your skull. You didn't feel that?
So, God, I gotta follow you now. She's like, I asked her how she's doing. She's like, I'm so nervous. And I'm like, oh, good. She goes first. So, Dave asked me, I think it was before your accident, you asked me to be, you know, part of the conference, and I was like, yeah, cool, count me in. And then he had his accident. We didn't talk for a while, and I checked in with him, and I said, did you still want me to do something in the conference? He's like, yeah, why don't you tell your story? Motherfucker. I would rather talk about anything else other than my story. My practice for so long has been to let go of all my stories, because all my stories are bullshit. Was actually one of my talks recently at Portland Insight. Was the real title was "All My Stories Are Bullshit and So Are Yours." We couldn't put that on the website, but so I think I'm going to go more in a chronological kind of thing, because I have a lot of childhood stuff, and it still arises. It still kind of affects. It's what I kind of react from. So I was born in the tumbleweeds in Palmdale. Lucky me, when my mom was pregnant, somebody knocked on the door, and it was Jehovah's Witnesses. And, yeah, this isn't a reaction to the way I was raised. So, my parents were seekers. You know, my dad, I guess, he tried transcendental meditation. He was having out-of-body experiences and got really scared of that. And then these people showed up at the door and showed them love and affection, and show them a system of utter repression and mind control, and that was their solution. And so I do remember early on that, and my dad progressed pretty good. He was a good speaker, he was an elder, he actually traveled around to different congregations and spoke. And I remember specifically being a little kid. My dad wasn't speaking, but you know, it was like a Sunday talk. And I was sitting in the audience, and I just remember, like, this doesn't make sense. Like, these interpretations of the Bible just seem wild. And I knew in my gut that it wasn't the truth. That's the term they use, you know, that what their belief system is called, the truth. It's also really ingrained into all the followers to not question anything. That you have to, if you're in it, you have to be in it 100%. And they talk about fence riders, that, you know, that if you're not 100% into it, you might as well be completely out of it. But, you know, as a kid, I had to eat and had to have clothes and somewhere to stay. So I, you know, I did the deal. I learned to give them what they wanted. To them, and then I learned to be, you know, with my friends and completely pretend like I'm not a Jehovah's Witness with my friends, and you know, but to be a, you know, good, you know, upstanding Christian boy in that organization. And so I learned to lie through my fucking teeth. I learned to be an actor. I really, within my family and you know, and ultimately within religion, I was not allowed to be myself. I couldn't express who I was, my own thoughts. I couldn't question anything. I couldn't wear what I wanted. You know, I had to wear a suit and tie and knock on the doors like a little kid. I was scared to death that one of those days I was going to knock on the door and it was going to be somebody from school or a friend of mine. I didn't want anybody to know that I was Jehovah's Witness. And so, you know, I very much lived in my head. You know, I couldn't be authentic. I couldn't be myself. I couldn't live my truth. I was, you know, one way over here. I was one way over there. I rode that fucking fence. And I suffered. It was, I think, think in sixth grade, it was the summer between sixth and seventh grade, I went to stay with my cousin. Nobody else in my family is Jehovah's Witnesses. I went to stay with my cousin, my aunt and uncle in Tucson. Somebody's from Tucson, right? Right on. I played quarters with my cousin and her boyfriend. And playing with the kid, they bullied up. You know, they just kept slamming the quarters in and, you know, making shots. And I threw up, and it was fucking glorious. And I felt, you know, just all that inner turmoil, all that, you know, repressed bullshit just went away. And it was a great summer, and I got to watch all the R-rated movies I wasn't allowed to. I'd watch Porky's and Scraggs. I saw pornos for the first time. It was wonderful. I remember Insatiable. I've given up on my age. And then I left that summer and I went back. And at that point, my dad had stopped going to the congregation for whatever reasons he had. And I came back and I was like, Mom, I don't want to be Jehovah's Witness anymore. And I got beat. And it scared my dad enough for him to start going to meetings again. And us going three times a week again. And that didn't play out the way I wanted it at all. And very much in my household, they use the, and I don't know if it's a biblical term or just the term spare the rod, spoil the child. That was, is that in the Bible? Yeah. Fucking bullshit. that was very much in my household. I don't know how many times I was spanked, I was hit, belt, wooden spoon, fist. I just this morning I was thinking, I spanked my oldest daughter once, and it came flashing back to me, and tears came up this morning, and I need to go check in with her. She's 16 now. That's not funny, by the way. So I got that taste of alcohol, and as much as I could from then on, with my, in the Jehovah's Witness realm, they're called worldly friends. You know, if they're not Jehovah's Witnesses, that's the world. Everybody else is very narcissistic. They believed that was the, they were the only true religion. They were the only true followers of God. And so all of you not only were wrong, but you were running with the devil. You were, if you were of any other religion or even secular, you know, follower of the government, you were with the devil. So very judgmental. And that's a big part of my story. So tons of suffering, living inside, total actor, full of judgment, and those times when I got a hold of alcohol. And then, you know, in seventh grade when I smoked pot. And when somebody told me to take a toke on the bong and then breathe out, I didn't realize I had to take my mouth off the bong, so I breathed in the bong and shot bong arm. I'm not a clean alcoholic or drug addict. I make messes. So the drugs and alcohol, I found relief. I found moments of freedom. And it was on. At the end of high school, I had the opportunity of staying here in California or move to Florida where my dad was. And just another series of bad mistakes, I decided, well, you know, my dad kept saying how much opportunity and there was great jobs in Florida. You know, come out, you know, it's the land of opportunity. And I go out there and it fucking sucked. For those of you from Florida, I'm sorry, I hate Florida. But it was interesting, so I get out there, and I I only hung out with Jehovah's Witnesses at first. You know, that's my dad. That was my dad's community, and so I met a bunch of Jehovah's Witnesses, and I found a group of guys that drank like me. You're not supposed to get drunk. You can. They're similar to Mormonism, but they can drink, but they can't get drunk. Which, what the fuck's, that's no fun. So you know, I found these guys that were baptized. That's another thing in the Jehovah's Witness thing. You get baptized when you're ready. And so you know, I was hanging out with these guys, and they like to drink, and I like to go to concerts, and I just figured, you know, I'm done with high school. I probably should get married when I'm 21, like the rest of them, because they don't believe in premarital sex. And so yeah, I got baptized, and it was kind of resolved. This is the way it is. And within 6 months, I got in trouble for having sex with my girlfriend and getting drunk. And I got on a public reproof. They do this, you know, thing within the community of announcing that, you know, that I was a fuck up. And you know, that was a big thing with Joe's. There's always this threat that if they remove you, or if you remove yourself, you're worse than the worldly people. You're considered an apostate, and they use scriptures to justify that you're supposed to be shunned. And so there's always that you know, that threat that, you know, if you leave us, you're done. And I ended up doing that. You know, after I got in trouble, I moved out of my parents' house, and then it was on. You know, now I didn't have to hide my alcohol and drug use. And although I did cocaine a little bit in high school, you know, now I'm in Florida and it's all over the place. And I got coke as much as I possibly could. I stole a lot from my job. I made pretty good money for the time, and just stole out of it sort of like crazy to support my habit. And just blackout drunk all the time. And I remember I was in Sarasota. It was one of the many, you know, went out clubbing alternative night at the local gay club, and I woke up in the morning in my driver's seat in front of the front door entrance of McDonald's that had just opened. So all these people are rolling in, and I was just like, "How did I get here?" And that was, I don't know how many times, you know, behind the wheel, blackout drunk. It got to a point I was really proud about the fact that I could open my throat up and just pour alcohol down my throat without, you know, like a Nick Cage in Leaving Las Vegas style. I thought that was really cool. I prided myself that I didn't have a conscience. That, you know, that was, you know, the Jehovah's Witness thing, that, you know, you should have this internal thing of not, you know, not being displeasing to God. And I got to a point to where, like, I can do anything I want. It doesn't bother me. And I can consume as much alcohol as I possibly want, more so than pretty much everybody was around me. And it was okay. Like, you know, I didn't get DUIs, and I didn't go to jail, and I, you know, and I got in fights and stuff, and had guns pulled on me, but, like, I was still alive. You know? And I think at that point, that was my first friend at OD'd and died. We got a hold of Dilaudid. I was supposed to hang out with Eric that night, and instead he went off with our drug dealer friend. They got a hold of Dilaudid, and he ended up dying. And it was sad, and it sucked, and it was one of those drug memorials. You know, we went to the church with his family, but then we all hung out at somebody's house and just got loaded and told stories about Eric and how great it was, and it didn't stop any of us. It was my friend Brad in Florida that first got me into Buddhism. We loved punk rock, we loved Cro-Mags, we loved all those Revelation bands, and he was a total Japanophile, and had you know, Suzuki and other Japanese Zen books around, and at the time I wanted nothing to do with organized religion. You know, I got out of the Jehovah's Witness thing. I actually found some comfort within the whole satanic death metal scene that was in Tampa at the time, the early 90s. That served me really well. I considered myself a Satanist. That, you know, I didn't have a conscience. I could do what I wanted. I thought it was, I think the internal thing, you know, that whole fence riding thing, if you're not 100% with us, then you're against us. So, like, I visually, and it was totally unconscious, but, you know, grew my hair long, tattoos creeping down my sleeves, super blasphemous, huge t-shirts went out of my, you know, it was the South. So I love pushing buttons. Remember in the early 90s, that the Calvin sticker of him peeing on something?
Yeah.
I had him peeing on a Bible. And there was a woman and her kids pulled up behind me, and I saw her look at my bumper, and she started crying. And I was just so proud of that. That's the stuff I placed a value on. So I started reading about Buddhism. It totally resonated within me. But, you know, at the time, I was just like, you know, some of the Zen stuff that I saw, you know, looked religious, you know, on TV. You know, the monks on Kung Fu. and I tried to meditate. You know, I sat in my bed. And I was, like many of us, I had the total misconception that when I was sitting in meditation, totally still, and all thoughts would leave my mind, and all sensations would leave my body. And so, you know, I sat in my bed, and just a fucking swirl of, you know, just fucking emotions, and I instantly was like, I can't do this. I'm broken. Judgment, criticism. I moved back to California. I had the opportunity to move back to California to work for a clothing company. Serial Killer, by the way. Serial Killer, Inc. that's an interesting thing. During that period, I really reached out to a lot of serial killers. I found them interesting, and I kind of felt a kinship. I felt like I was one bad decision away from being that, you know, or doing that. Richard Ramirez used to call me at my house. I was this whole underground scene of trading artwork from serial killers. So I had this opportunity to work for this clothing company called Serial Killer. So I came back out here to LA, and I started making really good money. And the way we marketed was to bands, mostly punk rock bands. And so it was, you know, going out every night. The owner of the company was a horrible addict, and his best friend was a coke dealer. So I got $100 eight balls. I made a lot of money. I got to see bands play every night, you know, within Hollywood. And I was loving it. Or so I thought. I was drinking, I was using so much, I was, you know, I was like my own pharmacist. You know, I woke up in the morning, I had to do a little cocaine. If I did too much, I'd have to start drinking. The minute I came down, I'd start doing more cocaine. At the end of the day, I'd, you know, eat at a Xanax bar and drink that down, because, you know, alcohol with pills makes it way better. Just to find that level, just to find, you know, just a little bit of relief. And I didn't think I didn't get much of it. I met her after many hers. I met a woman who liked to drink as much as me. She was in the record industry, and so, you know, between my connections, her connections, we could see bands play every night, and we'd black out drunk and just stumble home, and it was awesome. And we got pregnant, and despite the hedonist, nihilist, Satanist in me, I still had some of those values deep down. So I was like, okay, we're gonna get married. I do love her. I want to do the right thing. So we had our pre-wedding party at the Museum of Death on the first location on Hollywood, and cocaine and bands and serial killers. So man, I did. I totally planned this for 30 minutes. For 25. Okay. So, I finally got a DUI. At that point, I said, you know, because I didn't drink every single day, I didn't use cocaine every day. I thought, you know, I'm gonna stop doing everything for 30 days just to see if I have a problem. And I did it. I fucking white knuckled it, but I did it. And it really, it kept me going for like another 10 years until my last bender was in Las Vegas. I went there for work. I didn't bring any drugs with me. I ended up with a rock of cocaine that big the first night I was there. I tripped on mushrooms in the middle of the week. And I think the mushrooms helped. I came out of that trip and I had this very clear insight that I was lying to myself for years and years and years. That I thought I was partying. I thought I deserved it. I thought I earned it. I thought that you know, I wasn't hurting anybody, that I was having fun. And I clearly saw that I was creating my own misery. And so that was it. That was August 2007. I ended up finding a men's stag AA and really plugged in. And ended up, they threw me a commitment right away. I started leading the meeting every day. And somebody recommended Dharma Punks. Right when I read Dharma Punks, this center opened. So I started coming here. And really dove into my practice, and I got into mindfulness before I got sober, but I really dove into Vipassana here, and I know, I remember my story anyway. I kept bugging Noah all the time, like, let's have recovery meetings here, and I think it was at Brighton Bush. Remember I did that AA meeting at lunch one of the days, and then we ended up. It was about 8 years ago that me and Jordan right here, we started the first group, and it's just been an incredible ride. Am I over? The biggest thing for me has been metta and forgiveness. I really found when I started to practice loving kindness, you know, and although I'd been doing mindfulness for a while, when I started specific metta, when I went to offer to myself, I found that just the level of hatred and resentment and you know, judgment and criticism that I had. So, you know, I really dove in. I ended up, thanks to Noah's suggestion, I made a commitment of doing it a year. I ended up doing it for 2.5 years daily, offering it to myself. And it changed everything. I don't feel... That story I just told you, that's not me anymore. I feel comfortable in my own skin. I can speak with truth most of the time. I can honestly say that that meditation and this program specifically has saved my life. At least has saved my sanity. Seeing this blossom and grow has been incredible. You know, it was me and Jordan here and Joseph and Enrique at Santa Monica, and these meetings blew up pretty quickly. And you know, like Joseph said, there was other people that co-facilitated with me for a while, and they kind of, you know, Pablo was here for a little bit and dropped off, and Jordan kind of disappeared after a while. And I did this for 4 years, and until we decided to do this as a peer-led program. And you know, and it really transformed from there. The meeting that I kind of sculpted due to group conscious transformed. It changed. They started doing things their own way, and it's been beautiful. I mentioned yesterday I started the first one in prison at Tehachapi State Prison. I think that's still going. I've helped a lot of people all over the world start meetings, and. You know, and I moved to Portland a year ago, and I went to my first meeting there. Was a Sunday night meeting, a big meeting. Got there kind of late, and you know, the dim lights and you know, this big circle of people. Kind of, I mean, I'm tall, you know, it was a short ceiling, and and it felt like Fight Club. All these people, you know, the meeting had already started, and everybody's like, you know, no, it was just here last week, and you know, Refuge Recovery is my only program, and I've been in this since day one, and I just started this, but this is my thing, and Noah, and you know, I'm like, fucking talking about Tyler Durden. And I'm Tyler Durden, and you're Tyler Durden. And we all, and that's the cool thing, you know, we all show up, and like, maybe we don't know each other, but we know each other. You know, we've suffered to some levels that other people just don't understand. And we all recognize the potential. Whether we've gotten really far in our practice or whether we're really new in it, we all recognize that we have this potential. We can do this together. Through mindfulness, through forgiveness, through loving kindness, we can find freedom. I get taste of it all the time, and I still have a ways to go. So... is that my time?